And if you have any thought or concern or prayer or whatever you felt appropriate for the victim of the of those killing in Paris, of this terrorist attack, I thank you very much, and I hope you had nobody you knew or no one from your country who was killed in Paris this Friday. Okay, so now back to science, which is that's a way to prove that life is going on. So today we are going to continue the discussion about the effective action for the 5-4 theory and general quantum field theory, and start to discuss renormalization in this framework. So first, I'm going to do effective action. And second, renormalization, but that's just the first discussion. Okay, so last Friday, I just made statement. I showed that, in fact, the one particle irreducible diagrams, also the you can associate to the perturbative expansion of a quantum field theory some special subset of diagram which are the one particle irreducible part, or they are sometimes called vertex diagrams, which are basically the building block of perturbation theory and also the building blocks of scattering amplitude, everything. And I stated that the generating functional for this effective act, for this those part, is the effective action. I just gave a very formal definition of it, remember. I stated that if you start from a path integral, a quantum field theory, with a generating function for all its correlation function, which is given by a path integral of this form, I'm in the Euclidean setting so that there is no I factor, but this works as well for the real-time setting. The log of the generating function is a generating function for the connected diagram, namely the cumulant of the correlator. So this is connected. And then you can define formally the Legendre transform of this object, which is G dot phi minus W of G, where phi is just a classical field and it's the expectation value of the field operator phi when you add, of course, a source term. And therefore, this is the functional derivative of W of G with respect to G at a given point x. Okay, so and this is called the background field. So this was just a statement. I defined carefully what this was, but I didn't compute it. So what I'm going now to show that using path integral method, you can very easily give an expression for this, at least at first order in perturbation theory. So I'm going to do a one loop calculation. Calculation, which means first order in H bar. Remember that perturbation theory may be viewed as an expansion in powers of H bar. So to higher and higher quantum effects. Okay. And for this, path integral method or functional integral method are very, very useful tool. So for the moment, I just take a general theory and I don't specify what is the action? So this calculation will be valid for any series. Okay, so the question is, how do we estimate this when we consider that h bar is very, very small? Well, we have to integrate an exponential of something. There is a minus 1 over h bar times a function of phi. So what's dominate in this functional integral is the value of the field where this is minimum. You see. So what dominates is phi c, which is called the saddle point, which is the solution of functional derivative with respect to g of s of phi, I'm sorry, respect to phi, minus g equals 0. So this is called the saddle point. That's the point where s of phi is minimal. Okay. Of course, this equation can give you other solutions that are extremal or local maximum or local extrema, but we consider that we consider the minimum. Okay. And we are going to see when for phi to the 4 what this equation means. So if we know how to solve this equation, basically we have a field configuration. So phi c is a functional of the source term, g. Because in general, this is a nonlinear differential equation. Okay, so phi c is a functional. It's a function of another field, which is a classical field, g. Remember, g is g of x, and this means integral dx, g of x, phi of x. In d-dimensional space. Okay. And so now to estimate this, we can change the variables and find that any general phi can be written as phi c, which is a function of g, plus some correction, some shift, and locally, and we can expand it in terms of h bar square, because it turns out that the phi that dominates will be of order h bar squared. And if we now expand the action, so we expand the action, s of phi, we can write it as s of phi c. Then there will be a linear term that is going to be 0 because of this equation. So phi c is a solution of this equation. So there is a linear term that is 0. And then there is a term of order phi tilde, which is you just do a formal Taylor expansion. You are going to have an h bar divided by 2. And then this phi tilde times the second derivative. I'm sorry, phi tilde times the second derivative of s with respect to phi at phi c times phi tilde plus higher order terms. You see? And in this notation, what this means is simply phi tilde dot second derivative of s of phi times phi tilde means integral dx1, integral ddx2, phi tilde of x1, phi tilde of x2, times the second order functional derivative of the action with respect to this, taken at a given value of the field. So we are going to express that explicitly later on, but that is just what's called the Hessian function, the action S of phi. It's a matrix of second derivative. Yes?
Is phi c the field that minimizes the action, or the action minus j phi?
is what phi?
Phi c, does yes. that minimize the action? Or does it minimize
the action? It minimizes the action, the total action here. Yes, because it's a solution of this equation. So phi c, oh yes, I'm sorry. This was, I'm a bit perturbed. S of phi minus g dot phi, of course, is minimum.
So
yes.
Also expanding S of phi minus j dot phi, and not just S of phi.
No. We expand S of phi and we expand g of phi, but since this part is linear, it goes into this term. It goes zero.
Sorry.
Oh, so I'm sorry. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes, I'm very sorry. So this is minus g times phi c. Yes, sorry. Yes. Thank you very much. Yes. Okay. And so you see that now if we write this term and write it here, if we neglect those terms, we get a Gaussian integral for z of g. Yes?
Why do we multiply square root of h bar in
front of? It's just a normalization of phi tilde, a fluctuation around the saddle point, which makes that in the exponential, you get exponential of minus 1 over h bar times h bar over 1, so we get the term over the 1. See? So I'm going to write this. So if you do this approximation, then you write that g of g is just the exponential of this term, exponential of minus 1 over h bar s of phi c, times a functional integral over phi tilde, of exponential of minus 1/2, the h bar has disappeared, so you get this phi tilde dot second derivative of respect to phi tilde, which is just a Gaussian integral. And these terms will come out with 1 plus term of order h bar 1/2. Okay, which we neglect. So you see that. So this is now a Gaussian integral. So we can perform formally this integral, and we get the square root of a determinant, of minus the square root of a determinant. So we get that this is, or we can write it directly. We can write that when we take the log, we take that W of G is minus S of phi C, minus 1/2 h bar trace of the logarithm of this object. Because this is a quadratic form. This is a quadratic form. So we can take the trace of its log, which is equivalent to the log of its determinant. So we take the log of the determinant of quadratic form. Okay, so that's a very simple explicit formula. And now, I'm sorry, and there is of course plus g times phi c. Okay. So this is the leading term. And this is the quantum correction. This is a classical contribution. It comes just from extremizing something. Okay. So once we have done that, we can compute easily what is the Legendre transform. Because first we take the definition. Phi is delta, the derivative of W, which is a function of G, with respect to G. Okay, so it's given. So remember, so here, W of G depends on G, but you must remember that phi C, the saddle point, depends on G. So this is, remember, phi C depends on G, the source. So the derivative with respect to G of this object, first is given by the explicit term phi C. Okay. Plus something that we don't know yet, which is delta phi over delta G. Of phi c with respect to delta g times the explicit derivative of this with respect to phi c. So we get minus delta s of phi divided by with respect to phi plus g plus a term of order h bar. This is the definition of phi, and this is, you take the functional derivative of the trace of the log of this determinant with respect to phi. And you take it as phi equal phi c. I'm not writing it because I don't need it, but this is the derivative of this term. Okay. But you see that this is, by definition, zero. This is the definition of phi c. So you see that at classical order, phi is equal to phi c, the saddle point, plus a correction, but which is given by some quantum correction. So classically, background field equals saddle point. That's it. And therefore, if we now take the definition of gamma phi, which is g dot phi minus w of g. This is at leading order, namely at the classical order. This is g phi minus g phi c. Plus S of phi C plus H bar over 2 trace of logarithm of the second derivative of the action evaluated at the saddle point plus higher order terms. But now, this is g times phi minus phi c. So, at classical order, this vanishes, and s of phi c may be replaced by s of phi. You see, so at classical order, you can rewrite this as the classical action evaluated for a configuration of the field which is equal to the background field and not the saddle point, plus some quantum correction, h bar. And now, if you work a little bit more, I'm going to speed up things by not showing, it's just an exercise. You can check that, in fact, in these terms, there is no correction. So this term is equal to this one. And in this term, which is of order h bar, you can replace phi c, the saddle point, by phi, the background field, because the difference between this term S double prime of phi c and S double prime of phi is of order h bar. So this will be a term of order h bar squared. So in fact, the final result is that you can replace this by trace of logarithm of second derivative of S evaluated for a configuration of the field which is equal to the background field. Okay? And then you get term which turns out to be h bar squared. So we end up by just a functional integral calculation to this very important result. At leading order, so let me write it in a red box. So you see, at classical order, the effective action, the Legendre transform of the functional derivative of the connected function, is equal to the classical action. So that's why this quantity is called the effective action. Classically, it is equal to the classical action. So we did all these games for nothing. We gained nothing. But the first quantum correction, so the first semi-classical correction, exists. And it is given by the trace of the log of this object, which is namely the log of a functional determinant. But it has a very simple form, you see. And this form is valid for any theory with a scalar field. So it's a very general, valid for a quantum field theory involving scalar fields. Okay.
Of the order of h bar, isn't that the quantum correction of background field of the like j times the phi?
Yes, you're right. But what I just stated is that if you carefully evaluate the correction coming from this term, you have there is some term here. So it might give a correction to this term of order h bar. But if you are a bit careful, but it's very easy to see, you check that the correction is equal to zero, precisely because there is a relation between phi c and g, because phi c obeys this equation. So it turns out that this term, it's s of phi plus a term of order h bar coming from this term. You see? But the coefficient in front of this term is zero because of this equation of motion, classical equation of motion. So that makes the job. Okay? So this is the final result, which is formally a very simple form. And it's valid for any quantum field theory involving scalar field. And scalar field, in fact, the important fact is in fact, these are bosonic fields. So these are fields that are described by real numbers. So in fact, it's valid not only for a theory involving scalar field, but also gauge field and even graviton. You know, formally, the gravitational field is described by a spin two field, because it's a metric, whose components are scalar. So this result is valid for gauge theories and for quantum gravity. Well, modulo the fact that you have the gauge fixing procedure that modifies the result. But formally, it can be extended to, so bosons, but it can be extended to spin one and two fields, namely gauge field and quantum gravity or general relativity. Okay. So now we are going to use this. What does this mean for the 5-4 theory? Because this was very, very formal. So for 5-4 theory, remember the action is Euclidean action. This is just the integral over dx in d-dimensional space of 1/2. So let me write this phi times minus the Laplacian plus m squared phi, I mean periodic boundary, periodic space, plus g over 2 phi 4. Okay? So the classical equation of motion that defines phi c are just delta s over delta phi of x minus g of x, 0. This means that minus the Laplacian operator plus m squared apply to phi squared phi of x. So this is the Laplacian with respect to x. I take a first derivative, and here there is a factorial 4, so I get a g over 6 phi of x cube minus g of x equals 0. So this is the equation whose solution is phi c. So you see, so this is a nonlinear partial differential equation with a second term, a source term. Okay? So it's a complicated equation. It's called, in fact, if you want, time independent nonlinear Schrödinger equation, or if you want, a nonlinear Klein-Gordon equation with a source. So, mathematician in studying this kind of equation a lot. And we are in Euclidean time, so this is called what is called an elliptic equation because there is a Laplacian. Okay. No, so now, what does means this object? The Hessian. What is the Hessian? That's one x one, x two, the object I denoted, the second derivative of the action with respect to phi, but now in terms of coordinates, it depends on x1 and x2. So in fact, it's a matrix element of some operator. So we take the second derivative with respect to 2 phi, and what you get is, of course, simply minus Laplacian plus m squared. This is the quadratic form associated to this. And when you take 2 second derivatives of this, you get a g divided by 2 phi squared. Okay? And you take the matrix element between x point and x1 and x2. So, in fact, this object is for phi 4 what is the second derivative of the action with respect to phi, so it's called the Hessian, and it's a differential operator. So you see, S dot of phi is a linear differential operator. So by linear differential operator, we mean that it's an object that acts on function, but functions that are not phi. So you take any function psi, which is a function of on space, and you can define the action on the operator on a function, you see, by stating that this is a function evaluated at a given point x. This is simply the action of this differential operator that depends on phi on the function psi. So it's minus the Laplacian with respect to x plus m squared plus the multiplication of psi by this function g over 2 phi squared. So plus g over 2 phi squared at point x applied to the function psi of x. So, okay. So it's a so this is a non-linear object, but this is a linear differential operator acting on function that depends non-linearly on phi. But phi now is a parameter. You see. So you must. So this is linear. This it is linear on psi. Depends non-linearly on phi, which is a parameter. You must keep this difference. Okay. And now, once we have done that. Yes. Yes, so in fact, this means the internal kernel, integral kernel of the operator. So in fact, the integral kernel of this operator, S dot of phi, between 2 points x1 and x2 is equal to a distribution. So it's minus Laplacian with respect to x1 plus m squared plus g over 2 phi squared of x1, which is a differential operator applied on the integral kernel of the identity operator, which is a delta function of x1 minus x2. So it is a distribution. So this term is just multiplies the delta, the Dirac distribution, by some function. And this term will be the Laplacian of the Dirac distribution, which built out the Laplacian of the function psi when you apply this distribution to a test function psi. So psi plays the role of a test function in distribution theory. Okay. So this is the explicit expression for the Hessian operator for phi to the 4. And now what does, so this, for the effective action, this is going to be the classical action. And this is going to be a logarithm of the functional determinant of this differential operator. And we can compute this in perturbation theory, because in perturbation theory, what we have is that we can write trace of the logarithm of minus the Laplacian plus m squared plus g divided by 2 phi squared. Well, first, I can write this as the product of the Hessian of the free field. This is the Hessian of the free field, times I divide. So what I get is the identity operator plus g over 2 times the inverse of this operator times phi squared. OK? I did nothing. This is a log. Okay, so I did nothing at the moment, except that trace of log is log of a determinant of a product of two operators. So we can factorize, and we can write this as trace of logarithm of minus Laplacian plus m squared, which is the contribution, the quantum contribution of the effective action for the free field, plus trace of logarithm of 1 plus g over 2 minus delta plus m squared minus 1 times phi squared. Okay? So I'm not going to discuss this term at the moment. I'm going to discuss this term. This is the contribution of the free field. Okay. And I'm going to discuss this term. So these terms, we can expand it in G, because we can expand the log as a series. Again, be careful. Taking the trace of a series is not obviously equivalent to taking the series of the trace. But assuming that we can do that, we can write this term as sum from k equal 1 to infinity of 1 over k minus 1 to the power k minus 1, g to the power k divided by 2 to the power k, trace of g, I'm sorry, of minus the inverse of this operator times phi square of x to the power k. So we take the trace of a power of such an operator. Okay, so now what does mean this trace? And what is the product of this operator? So now, what is this object? Okay. Now we are going to write it explicitly in terms of integral kernels. So what is the integral kernels of this operator? So x1, well, xy, let's say. So integral kernel of such an operator, we know what it is. It is just the propagator of the free field theory. It is the object that is represented by this propagator. It's the propagator of the free theory. What is the integral kernel of this operator, phi squared of x? So if we consider it as an operator, it has an integral kernel. And the integral kernel of this operator is just the value of the function phi at a point x times delta of x minus y. See? So you can represent it just as a simple vertex with truncated line in our the representation I told Friday of irreducible function with two phi attached, but attached by truncated lines because it's just phi squared. I'm sorry, two phi. Okay, but in fact, see, here it will be var phi because I'm going to consider, so it's better to write this as var phi. Is it clear? So here, the point x is attached to this, this point y is attached to this vertex, and here you have a phi and a phi. You see? So it's an elementary vertex with two phi attached to the vertex of phi 4.
The var phi is the
agent
value of the phi.
Yeah, var phi is a value of the background field that we have to plug into this. So var phi of x is a value of the background field at the point x.
Where did you introduce the background field, like up to the like the backbone?
No, that's because I want to compute this object for a given configuration of the background field. So for a general, I have to compute this is the Hessian. It depends on phi. When I evaluate it for the value of the background field, I have to evaluate this. You see? So now I want to compute the h bar correction term as a functional of phi, the background phi. Okay? So I write what are the kernel operator associated to this operator and this operator. And then I evaluate the trace of the products of kernel operator. So what does it mean? The trace of this object is just, you know, you just take matrix element and you evaluate them. So you can write this formally as some big, big, big integral where first I have G naught of x1, y1. Then I have phi squared of y1, x2. G naught of x2, y2. The integral kernel of phi squared between the point x, I'm sorry, y2 and x3. And I continue until I end up with a k term where I am going to have a g naught of xk yk, a phi squared of yk, and in principle I should get an xk plus 1. But xk plus 1 is equal to x1 because I take the trace. So I have a big integral of such a term with dx1, dy1, up to dxk, dyk. You see, I've just been careful in writing the trace of these products of operator in terms of all the intermediate matrix element. But of course, this is a very, well, heavy notation because all these terms are just delta function. So what I can write is in a much simpler way is that I get an integral, a big integral over dx1 up to dxk of g naught of x1, x2, because y1 has to be equal to x2. Phi squared of x2, g naught of x2, x3, phi squared of x3, up to g naught of xk, x1. I end up with the same x1 than when I started one because I'm taking the trace, and phi squared of x1. Okay. And now, so this is a big integral. But in fact, it's a Feynman integral. It's an integral associated to a diagram. Integral of a Feynman diagram. And this Feynman diagram is very simple because you get a propagator that goes from x1 to x2, point 1 to e2. Then it goes from point 2 to point 3, point 3 to point 4, until you close the loop. Okay? So it's a polygon like that. Okay? And to each vertex, you get some two truncated lines. Where you have two phi points. Yes? Pardon?
Why are the lines truncated?
Well, the lines are truncated because what I mean by such a line, remember the rule that I had. What I mean by such a line, if I have a vertex here, a truncated line, and here a phi, and if this is a point x, this means just phi of x, that you can write as integral over dy phi of y delta of y minus x. If this vertex has a position x and this vertex has a position y. Sorry, this is a capital Y. I should write a little to make things clear. But I have a tendency to mix. And remember, the rules that I gave Friday, I've wrote that a truncated line like that between x and y, it was the same thing that sometimes I started by drawing it as a dashed line. It represents just delta of x minus y. Okay. So this is a bit a graphical way to represent the fact that if you have g naught of x1, x2, and g naught of x2, x3, that represent these two propagators, and that if I have a phi squared at x2, I have two phi sitting at the point x2. Okay. So you see that this is just a one loop diagram with 2k truncated legs. Okay?
Sorry,
yes?
I just don't understand why the lines are truncated. So you give us a definition, but why are truncated lines appearing in a diagram? Is that because you're using bar phi instead of phi?
Pardon?
Why are truncated lines appearing in the diagram?
It's just a way to represent this term. It means that I have a diagram, and to each vertex is associated a phi squared, but sitting at this point.
Yeah, but we weren't talking about truncated lines before, so is it because it's a background field now? Or?
No, it's just a definition. Take it as a definition of a truncated line. You know, this is a truncated line. And if I add no truncated line in my Feynman diagrammatic rule, this is just g naught of x minus. So that's an ordinary propagator. Okay. So take it as a definition. Okay. Yes.
Is that supposed to be x to x, or should there be a y somewhere?
No, here.
No, on the rightmost board.
See.
Here, on this board, the rightmost board. Yeah, top diagram.
Yes.
Should that be two x's, or should one of those be a y? You have two x's, but a phi y sum.
Now, if you have two phi, this means yes, you have two phi x, so you have phi x squared.
Both
we're saying that in that diagram, both
in
ends
diagram
of the diagram of x's.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is y here, and this is x. I'm sorry. This was a typo. Yes, thank you. Sorry. Okay. So this is just, you know, it's just a diagrammatic representation. The same than the one we had. Okay. So finally, I have to try to speed, to keep up with the speed. Then you see that now when you sum over the k, you get a sum of all the one loop diagram of the 5-4 theory with an arbitrary number of external legs. So final representation of gamma of phi. This term as one loop is just, so let me use this box, final representation. This term as one loop is just, you know, so what is the k order one term? I get a g divided by 4 times this diagram with a phi here and a phi here. So I get the tadpole diagram. This is a k equal n. K equal 2, I get the g, so I get in fact, well, let's better write this explicitly. I get a minus 1 over, I'm very sorry. This is a k equal 1 term, so this is 1 over k. Then I get a 1 half g over 2 squared times this diagram. Phi, term of order 3, 1 over 3, g over 2 to the power 3, this diagram. Etc. So you see that you indeed generate all the irreducible one-loop diagrams. They are all contained in this very, you know, compact notation. Okay. So this is the sum of a red part. And in order to be consistent, if you consider the free field contribution, I'm going to write it by just, I think, a minus a diagram like that, a loop with no external legs. So take it just as a notation. This is the definition of this object. It's just a definition. If you take a definition, for free field, you get the connected diagram with no external legs. Connected diagram with, well, irreducible diagram with no external legs, with two external legs, four external legs, six external legs, etc. You see? Okay. So this is, an experimental proof that this object at this order generates all the irreducible one-loop diagram. Okay. So I'm not going to prove that at order h squared that generates all the irreducible two-loop diagrams. The proof is more involved, but it can be made systematic, and I think it's, I have some words in the lecture note on that. So final representation, sum over one loop. One particle irreducible diagrams. Okay. So you see that this functional integral representation is a compact notation that for many Feynman diagrams. So for some calculation, it's very explicit. Yes?
These diagrams would be two one particle irreducible diagrams.
Yes.
They do not have these phis in there. I don't understand where these come from.
Because, remember, gamma of phi is a functional, it's a generating functional. Gamma of phi is a generating functional. So if you want to compute, for instance, and that's a good point because we are, if you want to compute what are the irreducible diagram? You see, with 2 points, z1, z2. You have to differentiate gamma of phi with respect to phi at the point z1, at the point z2. And if we get this, what do we get? We take one functional derivative of phi with respect to this phi and one functional derivative of phi with respect to this phi. So we get a factor g. This is a second derivative of phi squared divided by 2, so it's 1. So what you get is the contribution of this diagram with no phi attached. So this is a point z1. This is a point z2. Okay? And if you compute the sum of the irreducible diagram between point z1, z2, z3, z4, well, you have to take 4 delta phi. And what we get is that you have a g squared minus g squared divided by 8. But if you count well, you have 4 ways to distribute the derivative. So what you get is 4 times this diagram, where if you have 1, 2, 3, 4, plus this diagram with 1, 3, 2, 4, plus this diagram where you have 1, 4, 2, 3. You just have to work out the explicit functional derivative with respect to 4, 5. So you get 1/2 of 3 times this diagram. Yes?
What about the higher order? Are you doing derivative? What happens to the higher order terms?
Higher order in G?
Yeah.
Well, you get.
No. We're doing the derivative. When you're doing this fourth derivative term, would you have, if you have higher order in G terms?
No, that's because you have to take this at 5 for 0.
Okay.
Because it's a generating functional. Remember, the statement was that this gamma of phi is just an expansion into n, 1/(n), phi to the power n times the sum over all the irreducible diagram with n legs. To compute this, I take the nth derivative and I set phi equals 0. Okay.
How do you calculation of gamma simplify the calculation? I mean, at first sight, it doesn't really seem simpler than direct calculation of the irreducible diagram in position space.
Doesn't?
Yeah. Is it more simple? Is it simpler to calculate this?
No, it's just. I take the result of this functional endeavor calculation and I check that it is exactly the object I have defined in perturbation theory. Yeah.
Then can we explicitly calculate the gamma for given order exactly?
Yes, but that amounts to summing all the Feynman diagrams. So this is the explicit calculation. Mm-hmm. Of course, then you have to compute it, but you have to perform this integral. This is in general difficult. I get an explicit integral representation of this object, and it coincides with the integral representation in terms of integral associated to Feynman diagrams. Is that clear? Okay, the best way is to work out examples. So I'm going to continue to discuss those two. So this is the example of the two-point function, and this is the example of the four-point function. Okay, so now let's go on and start to discuss the second point, which is this. Why do we need a normalization? So I'm going to discuss first the two-point irreducible. Function. So the full two-point irreducible function. So the two. So the term of order two in phi squared that contains the classical action, and then this term that contains the one-loop diagram. So I'm going to discuss gamma. So what are the notation in the free field theory? I just need to settle for notation. So I'm going to consider the two-point function that depends on two points z1 and z2. And which is given by the second derivative of the effective action. So the first term is just the second derivative of the classical action. So it is the kernel of minus nabla between two points z1 and z2. So it's a derivative, it's a Laplacian of a delta function. And then I get g divided by 2 times the amplitudes associated to this diagram. Right here, z1 and z2. Okay, and there is, of course, an h-bar term. Okay. So this is the explicit expression of the irreducible two-point function. Okay, so now it's better to go from this by Fourier transform to gamma hat 2 of p, where p is an external momentum. And remember, in fact, by Fourier transform, gamma hat 2 will be a function of two momenta, but there will be a 2 pi to the power d delta of p1 plus p2 times some function of a single momentum, because this is this object with z1, z2, irreducible. And in Fourier transform, I can write it as a function of two momenta, incoming momenta p1 and p2.
Sorry.
But yes? No.
Why not?
No. Because this is the second derivative of the action. And the action is phi times minus Laplacian plus m squared times phi.
I want the propagator of the free theory.
No, but this is not the propagator. This is the effective action. And you are going to see the relation with the propagator in a minute. So if you take the Fourier transform of this object, get rid of the delta function that express the conservation of momenta, okay, because this object, which is a function of two points, is in fact a function of the difference between the two points because of translation invariance. What is the Fourier transform of this object in momentum scale? This is simply p squared, the squared of the momentum vector, plus m squared. And then I get g over 2. The Fourier transform of a delta function is just the identity. So it's something that doesn't depend on p, and let me just finish. And then I get the contribution of this propagator, which is g naught of 0, where g naught of 0 is the integral over d dk divided by 2 pi to the power d of 1 over k squared plus m squared. Okay? With an h bar factor. Yes? This expression comes just from the definition. This object is defined, if you want, as the second derivative of the quantum effective action with respect to a variation of phi at a point z2 at phi equals 0. That's the definition. That's the irreducible two-point function. You see? Pardon? What? It's the same than here. But this is, I'm sorry, this was a contribution of this at one loop. Yeah, I've been a bit sketchy here. Oh, it's not working anymore. Uh-huh. Ah, oh, no, this was because it was a phone. So this is the contribution of this at one loop. And this is the contribution of this at one loop. So now I'm just considering this where gamma is gamma classical plus gamma at one loop. And remember, gamma classical is just the classical action. Yes?
So this two-point function is defined to be evaluated at phi equals 0, then there won't be order h bar terms, will there?
No, there is a term of order h bar.
H bar squared.
Order h bar. Yes. Then you have term of order h bar squared. No, if you evaluate them at phi equals 0, you have term of order h bar squared. The term of order h bar squared are given by the graph at two loops, and we have seen that there are these two diagrams. If you remember the snapshots of the diagram that I showed Friday, you have these two loops diagram.
But at one loop, there
wouldn't be. But at one loop, there is only
this one. Right,
okay. This is the only diagram at one loop. Basically, there is only one diagram at one loop up to permutation of the external legs. You see, for instance, here you have three different diagrams, but that's because the external legs carry different labels, so they will carry different momenta. But topologically, it's the same diagram. While at second order, there starts to be many different diagrams at two loop. Yes?
So in that diagram you drew, that's implicitly by the Z1 equals to Z2.
Here there is a delta function of Z1 and Z2.
And we require Z1 to be equal to Z2, right?
It turns out that if you compute this for Z1 different from Z2, you get a delta function. The only contribution on 0 is when Z1 is equal to Z2.
And is there a two-factor there? Mm-hmm.
Is there
a two-factor there in the first line of the two-point review?
No, there is no factor. You mean here? No.
Second term.
This one?
Yeah.
No, because here there was a factor at... That's because, remember, gamma one loop is h bar over 2 tres log of s. So, indeed, here there is a factor 1/2. I'm sorry, still a typo. This is the representation of the trace of the log, and this is the representation of gamma, one loop. So I should have written this. And here there is a 1/16. I'm sorry, I'm making typo. And here there is a factor 8, if you count. Wait, yes. So the final result was correct. That's because, yes, I'm very sorry. I'm getting messy. Okay. So this is a two-point function in momentum space. And you see that for the free theory, gamma 2 of P for the free theory, let's say here not for free, is P squared plus M squared, while the two-point function for the free theory is 1 over p squared plus m squared. So you see that there is a simple relation that basically the two-point function as a function of p is 1 over, in Fourier space, the inverse of the two-point function, of the irreducible two-point function. So this is a two-point function, connected two-point function. And this is the irreducible two-point function. Okay? And in fact, that's a general relation. It's true not only for the free theory, but it's true for a general theory, for a very simple reason. If you are interested in computing a two-point function with connected diagram for the two-point function of the 5-4 theory, you see, you have one propagator that carries some momentum, then it goes into this big connected diagram, and then it goes there. But we have seen that we can write a connected diagram in terms of trees whose vertices are irreducible diagram. So this is a tree decomposition. And this tree decomposition for a single line connecting, you know, carrying momenta, is such that you can align irreducible diagram to form a chain. And you can sum over k. So we have a chain of k irreducible vertices. But basically, if you work out what's going on in terms of the amplitude associated to the diagram, this chain in momentum space is just the product of a propagator times an irreducible two-point function times a propagator, you see, in momentum space. So it's just a geometric function. So it's just sum. It's just, you can write this as this. You want these diagrams times 1 over 1 minus these diagrams times an irreducible diagram. Formally. So this is a diagrammatic representation that are an identity in momentum space, where this is a function. That's it. So what I mean by this is just that if I have a truncated function, irreducible, that is function of some momenta, it's some kernel, let us say, sigma of p. It's a function of p. So this means that g hat of p is just 1 over p squared plus m squared, times 1 over 1 minus 1 over p squared plus m squared times sigma of p. You see? Which means, of course, 1 over p squared plus m squared minus sigma of p. And this is the irreducible two-point function in momentum space. You recognize p squared plus m squared, which is the inverse of the propagator, and this object, which is the contribution of the irreducible two-point diagram. And the fact that there is a minus sign here means that you have a plus sign here. While in the perturbation theory of the connected function, there is a minus g. Okay, so this explains why this relation is a general relation. The connected two-point function in momentum space is the inverse of the irreducible two-point function. So you see the connection between the irreducible two-point function and the propagator of the theory. Okay. So now we start to do the connection with the physics, because this object contains information about physics. And now I have basically 15 minutes to start to discuss renormalization. So I'm just going to discuss very briefly what's going on. So first, so now, forget about the diagrammatic and start to think a little bit back to physics. I should do that. So first, remember, this diagram, like this, has an amplitude, a Feynman amplitude, which is given by an integral, let's say I of this object. I'm going to call it T because it's a tadpole of the tadpole diagram. And we have seen that it is integral d dk. Well, this is capital K. We are in 2 pi to the power d, 1 over k squared plus m squared. And we have seen that this is ultraviolet divergent because the integral diverge when k goes to infinity if the dimension of space-time is larger or equal to 2. So in fact, this object is not very well defined. And that's because this object is also equal to g naught at x equals 0. And we have seen that g naught of x behave in momentum space as x to the power 2 minus the dimension of space-time. So this is a consequence of the ultraviolet singularities of the quantum field. So it's a very feature. Okay, so this is a feature of QFT. Okay, so how does physicists dealt with this problem? So one way to deal with this problem is to think that, in some sense, you can modify the theory to improve the short distance behavior. And this is called to be a regularization procedure. Okay. This means you change the behavior of the theory at short distance. You modify it. And we have seen that one example is to take a lattice in space-time. So we replace RD by ZD. And we already discussed that. And in this way, the integral over all whole space-time, well, the whole momentum space is replaced by an integral over a Bridouin zone, which is a finite extension. And therefore, the integrals become finite. Okay. Well, you can also modify the propagator, for instance, by using what is called the sharp momentum cutoff. Stating that in all this integral, the momentum k has to be taken to be less than some very big. And lambda will always be much larger than the mass of the particle, so that we expect not to change too much the behavior of the theory at physical distance, physical scale. Okay. Well, there are other methods of regularization that I'm not going to discuss. So, for instance, you can improve a sharp momentum cutoff in a smooth way. And it's often called Polyvillard regularization. You can use what is called dimensional regularization by assuming that the dimension d is different from 4, for instance, but is a complex number, which is some kind of fancy regularization, but it has very nice properties, in particular for gauge theories. So we're going to go back to that, but this was an important ingredient of the proof that gauge theories are consistent. And finally, there is the ultimate regulator in our world, which is Planck's length. Or, if you prefer, Planck's mass, which plays a role of an ultimate momentum cutoff. Because we know that the physics as we know it, the physics of local field, has to be modified to incorporate gravity, if we can. So there is an ultimate regulator which that plays a role of lambda, and L Planck's will play the role of the lattice cutoff, if you want, lattice mesh A. So anyway, we know that somewhere, when we do calculation in quantum field theory, there is a very large cutoff, and we try to do our best for physics at the scale of, let's say, the ordinary world up to the LHC to forget about that, because the physics of gravitational field is not important, we hope. But it's there. Okay, so I'm going to discuss at that level just the sharp momentum cutoff and see what's going on when we evaluate those integrals. So when we evaluate those integrals, you see basically that in four dimension, T, this integral, yes, which is a function of the mass. It's only a function of the mass. But in fact, so T is a function of the mass. But in fact, it's a function of the cutoff. If you define this integral as integral, so I'm going to work in four dimension, 1/k² + m². So I'm going to work in dimension 4. Okay. So if you now integrate a cutoff, namely you state that k, you integrate in a sphere where k is less than lambda instead of a whole space, so we integrate in a ball, then the divergence is diverged like some momentum to the power 4 divided by k squared, so we expect that it diverges at lambda squared. It's an easy calculation to check that. This is 1/, there is a coefficient which turns out to be 1/4π². Okay, so this is a leading term, and the leading term is independent of the mass because the leading term from the fact of this coefficient. But it depends a bit of the mass, and if you compute how it depends on the mass, you discover that there is an m² / 4π² again times a log of lambda squared plus finite terms when lambda goes to infinity. So this is the divergence of the statpole amplitudes. There is a leading quadratic divergence, and there is a subleading logarithmic divergence. Okay? And this subleading logarithmic divergence, you can check that it comes, if you work in space fast, in the fact that the propagator behaves like 1/k² at short distance, but then there is a subleading log of k. Oh no, there is a subleading 1/x. A log of x term. So there are subleading correction. Okay. Okay. So what does mean that the fact that we have such a divergence? Well, if you use this result, the fact that the two-point function is the inverse of the irreducible four-point function. I think you have seen in the QFT one course that the you have a decomposition of the two-point function, which is called the Lehmann-Chelin representation. Has it been discussed in QFT one or not?
I stated the result.
What?
I stated the result, but I didn't.
Yeah. Okay. So you can state that in the following term. So first, remember, for instance, that we have seen that. We can state it in a different way. Go back to g of x, the two-point function here. Which is a Fourier transform, the inverse Fourier transform of 1 over the irreducible four-point function. So this is the Fourier transform, the two-point function in momentum space, and this is the irreducible two-point function, no, in position space and in momentum space. Okay. And you see that remember that this is a function of k squared. And remember that k squared is basically, I'm working in Euclidean space. So if you go back to Minkowski space, k squared is the momentum, space momentum plus the mass of the particles minus e squared. No, I'm sorry. K squared is, there is no mass. It's K squared minus E squared. Okay? Because K is the momentum square and plus or minus, I don't remember, I times some frequency, so some energy. Okay. Because I'm working in Euclidean space. Okay. So you see from the explicit expression we have here that p squared, the two-point function, gamma 2 of k, behaves like k squared plus m squared plus h bar g over 2 this number t, which is divergent. Is it clear? I should show this a bit more. Okay. And let's call this capital M squared, this number. You see that this has a zero when k squared equal minus m squared. So if you consider this function as a function of the momentum squared in the complex plane, it has a zero on the negative real axis. You see? Which means that that g squared has a pole of g squared or k, where g squared is a two-point function. That's a two-point function. It's a propagator of the series. Okay? And the fact that it has a pole here means that it has a pole when k squared is negative, namely when the energy is positive. You see? And so it corresponds, in fact, to the fact that the theory has a one-particle state with physical mass capital M, the interacting theory. So in other words, and I think I would need a blackboard here, so let me just use the blackboard. It means that if the free theory, the particle, the one particle state has mass little m, in the interacting theory, the one particle state has mass capital M with M squared equal mass of the free theory plus G h bar over 2 T, where T is this integral. And that's something that you have heard about already. It means simply that the mass of a one particle in the interacting theory is renormalized by radiative correction. M is different from M thanks to quantum corrections. Because this diagram, if you want, represent that the fact that you have a particle that interacts with a particle that is created out of the vacuum by a quantum fluctuation. It's just a physical language. But it interacts with particles that are created by vacuum fluctuation. And remember, the interaction is repulsive between particles. They behave like balls, hard balls. So if you have particles, if you are trying to move into a gas of balls and hit the balls, you are slowed down. It's a very, very unwavering argument. And therefore, it's harder for you to move. So you have more inertia because you are carrying out a cloud of virtual particles that you hit everywhere. So it means that you have more rest energy than what you had if you were in the vacuum, because if you are sitting in the vacuum, you have all these particles you interact because they hit you. And so the mass increases. The physical mass, so M is the physical mass, and it's larger than the, if you want, the naive mass that you expect from, if you start from the free theory.
Because it seems to me that they have the opposite sign.
No.
Because here we have m squared minus sigma of t, and down there we have m squared plus t. So I don't see how.
Oh, no, that's because here the sigma that I define here is minus as a minus sign. So I was a bit sketchy.
Oh,
check. I was a bit sketchy here. If you look at my notes, the sigma is really defined as the irreducible function, and then you get a minus sign. So you get,
okay,
this is one over one plus. That was a bit sketchy. There is a minus sign per irreducible part here, so here it's a plus. Anyway, redo the calculation. And so, so you see the effect of the physics, so that's a physical effect that is very well known. It's just that mass of particles contains radiative corrections. This was discovered by the pioneer of QED, like Feynman and Tomanaga and Schwinger, and people started before that. Well, I think it started with Heisenberg and Pauli and others. Okay, the mass is renormalized by radiative correction and by quantum effect. Okay. So, and what this means, in fact, is that the physical, if you start from a theory with a finite if you start from a free series with a finite mass, then if M for the zero series is finite, and we compute naively, the first order quantum correction gives a physical mass which is infinite because it's proportional to lambda squared. Okay? But, of course, we want to construct a quantum theory with a finite physical mass. So, we want a theory with a physical mass that is finite. And the question is, how can we start from a free theory, that is what it is, to get a physical theory with a finite mass? And that's the prospect of renormalization. And next time, I'm just going to discuss the simplest case, which is the case of the massless phi 4 theory, because you are going to understand what's going on about renormalization. And massless phi 4 theory means simply that I'm going to try to construct an interacting theory at first order in G, namely in H bar, which has a physical mass equal to zero, because that's simple, that's interesting, because it will have properties of what's called scale invariance. So it's interesting, it's sound, and it's simple, because we are going to discuss what's really important in the quantum theory, which is that not only the masses are renormalized, but the coupling constant are renormalized. So the strength of the interaction of the theory is renormalized. And that's really the important feature of a quantum field theory. In some sense, renormalization of a mass, well, it's important, but it's something that occurs already in some classical models, if you want. While renormalization of the coupling constant, of the strength of the interaction, is really a quantum effect. So it's not only a quantum effect, but it's a quantum feature of QFT. Okay, so thank you.